Well, about this time, I just made a little project of my own. I spent a little time in the library, in the law library, and I convinced myself that these rules that the court had proposed amounted to judicial legislation. Mm-hmm. That is, that if you had to categorize them, it was a judicial exercise of a legislative function. And I also convinced myself that we had federally protected constitutional rights as lawyers to practice our profession under state statute. And I thought that jurisdiction would lie in the U.S. District Court to bring suit against the justices as individuals and attacking the constitutionality of what they were trying to do. And we took this up with the Board of Governors. There must have been an emergency meeting or something. And anyway, the upshot of it was that I was hired to prepare and file a complaint, which I did. And I remember I wouldn't let anybody else sign it. I was it was my work and I wanted credit for it. Although we had numerous other counsel. I'm sure Ed Boyko, George Boney, Wendell Kay, John Savage, I think these were listed as counsel. Mm-hmm. And since we were attacking the constitutionality of federal constitutionality of a state statute, mm-hmm. Namely these new court rules, we demanded a three-judge court and got it. Mm-hmm. And that's when things got... Everybody said it couldn't be done, but we did it.
Were any of the insurance defense people involved in fighting the court?
Every one of them was involved.
Because the people you name are still all... Plaintiffs.
No, the caption of that complaint. What I did was, Pam, I phoned or talked to personally every lawyer in the state of Alaska.
Oh, I don't. I'm not talking about their support. Did any of them come out on the face and fight?
Oh, you bet.
They did.
The most beautiful letter, describing to the Supreme Court what they had done, mm-hmm. was from Chuck Clasby. And I asked Chuck one time, I said, it's the most beautiful letter. And I said, Chuck, how many drafts did you put that letter through? And he said, six. Unanimous. I know it's part of the court file.
Okay. And there's a court file that has all this stuff?
Yeah, U.S. District Court, you bet. But what I did was, I talked to every lawyer in the state, and I think there were about 165, mm-hmm. and I think about 162 of them authorized me personally to file that suit as their attorneys. Mm-hmm. So I listed them all in the caption, every last one of them. And the caption of that case is a roster of the Alaska Bar, mm-hmm. and there were only two or three that didn't go along. One of them was Harlan Davis. And forget who the other two were.
Why?
Just couldn't see the point. I don't, you know, you can't convince everybody of anything. But we got about, I would say, 162 out of 165. Mm-hmm. And away we went. Well, then Chief Judge of the Ninth Circuit granted our demand for a three-judge court. the court was constituted was Judge Jertburg of the Ninth Circuit.
That's J-E-R-T?
Mm-hmm. B-U-R-G. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fabulous judge. Mm-hmm. Maybe the best judge on the Ninth Circuit at that time. And Bill Beeks of Washington, Seattle. B-E-E-K-S. Mm-hmm. And he's a district judge. And Hodge.
From here.
Yeah. So that was our three-judge court. And I went back to the Board of Governors, and I said, I know what happened. Justice Nesbitt went to Baltimore and hired George Cochran Daub, D-A-U-B, mm-hmm. former Assistant United States Attorney General. Daub had been some help, I think, in setting up the Alaska court system originally, mm-hmm. when we had no court houses or courtrooms or stuff. So Buell hired George Daub to represent the three justices of the Supreme Court. Who? Arend, or Nesbitt, Arend, and Diamond. And so I went to the Board of Governors and I said, hey, you know, I think we ought to counter that by getting outside counsel of our own and get some distinguished constitutional lawyer. And I would like to get Joe Ball if we can get him, because he had just been the main speaker at our banquet in our convention, mm-hmm. and we'd all been very taken with him. And so the board said okay. So I phoned Joe and told him what I've told you, and he says, love to help you fellas. So from then on it was really a battle between Joe Ball of Long Beach and George Cochran Daub of Baltimore. And they went at it hammer and tongs. Now, there was no law in Alaska on the whole subject of disciplinary powers there was no law in Alaska on the subject of the inherent power of the Supreme Court of Alaska over lawyers, if any. And it was a complete void. And the law of the various states was conflicting because, California had this statutory system which worked very well, and the Supreme Court of California kind of stepped back and let the bar do its thing. Oregon, not so. The Supreme Court of Oregon seemed to participate much more in grievance matters. So, the showdown came on Daub's motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction to do what we'd asked to be done. And briefed and argued at great length, and motion denied. And there's this hiatus in the law. So, Justice Nesbitt ordered Ernie Raybock to go through the old grievance files, old and new, to find, I don't know what the status was or whatever, and I don't know just how the decision was made. There was already some bad blood between Nesbitt and McKay. I don't know, whether it had something to do with business or law practice or what, I don't know. But I know that Buell was not fond of Neal. And there had been an old grievance against Neil McKay, which had been processed, and he had been exonerated by the Board of Governors, and Boutcheever was president at that time. So you know it was properly handled. You know, Bob was a fanatic for detail and for doing things right. First thing that anybody knew, or that McKay knew, was he got an order to show cause from the Supreme Court of Alaska why he should not be disbarred for cheating his client. And McKay's response to that was, I was exonerated by the bar of that same charge, and it's, you know, res judicata. No, said the Supreme Court of Alaska. So Nesbitt started writing opinions.
After the suit was commenced?
Yes. Well, after the suit was commenced, Buell wrote 3 or 4 opinions, all entitled, you know, In Re McKay, in which he set forth the law of Alaska concerning bar associations, attorneys, the whole nine yards, you see. He was going to head the U.S. District Court off at the pass. He was manufacturing law in his own office over there in the Supreme Court. And later on, when the American Bar Association got into it and sent a committee up here, Chief Justice Rosalini, R-O-S-S-E-L-L-I-N-I of the state of Washington, took me aside and assured me that if the Chief Justice of Washington had done what Chief Justice Nesbitt did in the McKay case, he would have been removed from office and permanently disbarred. And that's a quote. And Rosalini said, the reason I know this is because we just did it to a couple of lawyers from Tacoma who had a big lien case pending in federal court. And it hinged on some question of lien law that had never been decided in the state of Washington. So these guys dummied up a little insignificant little lien case in the state court and took it up on appeal, Supreme Court of Washington, and got the Supreme Court of Washington to rule the way they wanted it to rule. And when the truth came out, those guys were gone. And Rosalini felt that that was the situation we had here, and I felt the same way. And Joe Ball felt that way. And I persuaded Joe to, since the McKay thing had become so intertwined, represent Neil as well, McKay as well as the bar. So we did. We filed another suit in U.S. District Court, this time just McKay against these three justices, setting forth all this. And this is funny. When the three-judge federal court denied the motion to dismiss, the defendant's motion to dismiss, it was the handwriting on the wall was very, very clear. In fact, I think we had a conference in chambers with the three, I know we did, with the three-judge court, Raybock, Daub for the defendants, and Joe Ball and me for the plaintiffs. And the gist of what Judge Jertberg said was that they had denied the motion to dismiss, and they, but they urged the parties to settle the case. They said, "You're not going to, this is not going to do the bar or the judiciary any good if we are forced to make a final decision in this case." And by then, all the facts had been presented to them in connection with the motion. Mm-hmm. And I remember Jertberg saying, turning to us, you know, and he said, "And you fellows are not going to be entirely happy with our decision." Because, he said, "We have denied the motion to dismiss on the sole ground that these proposed bar rules are amount to legislation, mm-hmm. and that they may be unconstitutional. But that doesn't solve your whole problem, see?" And so there may be things about our decision, forthcoming decision, that you won't like either. So we urge you to.
What did they mean by that?
Well, I took it that Jertberg was telling us that, in their opinion, they thought that in the long run, we probably couldn't prevent the Supreme Court from doing what they wanted to do, mm-hmm. if they just went about it properly. And which is about what they've done, I guess, since. The case was settled. But it was settled, as I recall, it was settled on our terms.
How was it settled?
Yeah, sure. They withdrew, the Supreme Court of Alaska withdrew every order that they had made. You know, about seizing the mm-hmm. property and all that stuff, removing the board. All those objectionable orders were withdrawn. Mm-hmm. A new set of bar rules was drafted and came out of a conference we had at Juneau, kind of a joint meeting with the Supreme Court.
Who was at the conference?
Oh, I know Daub and Ball were not. It was Alaska bar people. I know I was there. And I know Justice Nesbitt. I don't know why the other two justices appeared. But anyway, what we...
Oh,
yeah, there should be.
Who would have it?
Alaska Bar. Somewhere.
That was... When was that?
No. I know the fight started... It's sort of... 1964 is the year that... First we had the earthquake, and then we had the bar fight, as I recall it,
so
in that order. But probably 65, somewhere around there. But what we did was we hammered out a new disciplinary rule, mm-hmm. and which the Board of Governors enacted, and the Supreme Court approved. And I think that... I don't know, the rule stated, or some rule stated, that we wouldn't enact any disciplinary rules without consulting them first. It was some kind of a sop like that, you know. But that's all they got out of the whole thing.
When did the ABA come up to meeting?
Quite a bit before that. The ABA could see the whole, their whole thing going down the tube. Well, I mean, we had just challenged the power of state Supreme Courts over lawyers, mm-hmm. their inherent power. We said they didn't have any.
Yeah.
And this ran counter to the grain of most of the fat cats in the American Bar Association.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, they really felt threatened by the whole proceeding, and I think also, you know, the ones that probably the states that had statutory bars felt in jeopardy too. Mm-hmm. And the states that had court integrated bars probably felt threatened, and I'm sure that those some of those judges did.
Who asked for the mediation board?
Came out of the American Bar, I think.
They just sent someone up.
I think they got in touch with us and asked us if we would consider meeting with a committee to be appointed by the American Bar Association.
For what purpose?
To try and mediate the dispute. This was probably, I don't know that whether this was before or after the motion to dismiss was denied. Mm-hmm. I think it was before.
That's true.
But don't really remember.
Would that be in the court record?
I don't think that the American Bar Committee ever got involved in the court record or proceedings. It was an informal mediation effort by the American Bar.
So it isn't what led you to settle in the district court, or did it?
No, their efforts at mediation were a failure, and in fact that the American Bar Committee didn't really agree. They agreed that the situation was terrible, but the committee, of course, was Dean Schweppe of the University of Washington Law School and Chief Justice Rosalini, and then the Chief Justice of Oregon, name I can't call right now, but he was sort of siding with our Supreme Court, because the procedure in Oregon is that after the bar gets through with a grievance matter, it automatically goes to the Supreme Court of Oregon for review. And Rosalini said, "Oregon, you're wrong." He said, "You know," he said, "it's not the way we do it in Washington." He and Schweppe both agreed on this. Said, "In Washington, if a lawyer gets in trouble, we don't want to hear about it if there's any way we can avoid it. And we let the bar handle it. If the bar acquits, that's it. And the only time we ever see it is if the bar convicts. Then we have to impose a sanction, you know, but and then I think only in case of disbarment, you know, if the bar could handle it, discipline them any other way, it would never officially go to the Supreme Court of Washington. So, that committee's efforts were a failure.
What about Judge Stewart, or Tom Stewart, the court administrator then?
Yeah.
What was his involvement in this whole thing?
Well, he was working under Justice Nesbitt, mm-hmm. and Roger Cremo was the hero of this, attorney for the First National Bank, and a guy who cared a lot about the bar, and Roger got this. I remember he phoned me, and he'd gotten this ridiculous order from the Supreme Court of Alaska taking over the Bar Association's bank account. And Roger phoned me first, and he said, "We're, you know, considering whether to honor it or not." And then I don't know who helped, or whether Roger did all by himself, or whether Cliff Groh or somebody else was in on it. This business of show of force, I had nothing to do with that. I certainly exploited it after it happened. But there was a state trooper who was serving this writ to take over the bank account. And I think he's dealing with the cashier of the First National Bank. The cashier, you know, the head man, and Cremo was on the telephone, and Cremo let the trooper know that, and I guess Tom Stewart know, that the bank was considering whether or not to honor the writ. But Roger somehow let it slip that the bank's position, they were minded not to honor the writ, but their position might be different if there was a show of force. And this poor dumb trooper pulled his gun and pointed it at the cashier. The First National is just next door to the Anchorage Times, and the Times was getting a lot of fun out of this whole thing, and as they always do. So it was a great headline in the Times about the Supreme Court sticking up the First National Bank, which is in effect what they did. We got a photographer from the Times to go over and take some pictures of Justice Nesbitt just after he'd gotten the news about Tom sticking up and the trooper sticking up the First National Bank. Now, Buell was fit to be tied, you know, and the photographer took about 10 pictures of him in Chambers there. His hair was standing right straight out, and he looked like the wrath of God. Well, and he went over the 10 pictures and printed the worst ones on the front page of the Times with this great big headline about what Supreme Court holds up bank. And here's our Chief Justice. And it's a wonder Buell didn't have a stroke when he saw what we'd done to him. And then thereafter, in the McKay litigation and in the federal litigation, the bar litigation, every time we made it a rule, I made a rule anyway, every time I filed a pleading or a paper of any kind, attached a copy of that headline and the picture from the Anchorage Times. We worked it into every affidavit, every motion, everything. So you go through the court record, you know, and it looks like about every fifth page is this picture of Justice Nesbitt with this awful headline. We really rubbed their nose in it.
How did the other bars feel about it? I mean, this is the Anchorage bar that was doing this.
They were behind us 100%. We never had any problem. Oh, yeah, now we get to the final. We've made the settlement in Juneau, and we're getting the final settlement. The three-judge court is reconvened. Joe Ball's up here, Dobbs here, and when we're closing out the case. Mm-hmm. And we made them make an order withdrawing their order against McKay. Mm-hmm. That's not right. But we made them withdraw an order that had a bearing on the McKay case. Mm-hmm. And the McKay case was handled differently. And they made that order instead of current date. We required them to make all these orders nunc pro tunc as of the time they should have done them. Mm-hmm. And this one order, because it bore on the McKay case, they wouldn't do it. They balked. They wanted to date the order as of that day and leave out the nunc pro tunc business. Mm-hmm. And they feared they were still intent on disbarring McKay. And Nesbitt feared that this order, if they'd presented it in the form which they'd agreed with the federal court they would do, that this would somehow pull the rug out from under them in the McKay case. So they came in with a Mickey Mouse, ambiguously worded order that just couldn't have been in good faith. And so Ball and I said no. Not in this form. It's got to be redrawn. And George Cochran Dow said to the three-judge court, he said, well, now this was in chambers, but on the record, Bonnie Britt was the court reporter. In chambers, on the record, three-judge court, okay. Dow said, the only reason they're finding fault with this form of order, Your Honors, is that they have a conflict of interest. They not only represent these rebellious lawyers, but they represent Neil McKay personally. And they have a conflict of interest. And on the record, in front of the three judges, Joe Ball, God bless him, he got up and he went over with his foot and he marked an X on the carpet, like this. And he said, George, you either take that back right here and now, or I am going to knock you on your ass right here. And it was so hilarious. A narrow doorway into Judge Hodge's chambers. These three federal judges got up and all headed for the door at the same time, and they jammed up in the doorway. Beeks, particularly, almost overweight as I am. And he was blocking the door, and the other two couldn't get through. Bonnie didn't know whether to keep on with her stenotype, you know. But Joe Ball's a scrapper, and he would have hit Dowd. Dowd took it back. Finally got straightened out, and we redrew the order, and they did it our way. So it was a complete victory for the bar, and they went ahead and disbarred McKay, and McKay took it up on appeal. And while his appeal was, his petition for certiorari was pending, I think, it was finally denied by the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, your chance is about 1 in 70 of getting cert. But meanwhile, we had, Wally Hickel had been elected governor. Ed Boyko was attorney general. And we packed the Supreme Court. What Roosevelt failed to do, we did. Mm-hmm. And
you got the two more seats.
Sure. And we defeated Harry Aaron, mm-hmm, for re-election, and we got
Rabinowitz,
who was an independent thinker. And I think one of the plaintiffs in the bar suit, he must have been. Yeah. And then we got Wally Hickel elected governor and Ed Boyko as attorney general. And the governor was thoroughly briefed on this and other problems with the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that Wally Hickel called the Chief Justice up or into his office, one or the other, and told him that unless the Supreme Court of Alaska requested the appointment of two more justices, that they would be very disappointed when the new budget came out. I've heard it said that Wally told Buell that he was going to take the carpet right off his floor if he didn't request the two new justices. And so Buell caved in and they did it. And we got George Boney and Roger Connor, two flaming liberals and two of the ringleaders in the former fight against the Supreme Court on the bar thing. And then the most marvelous thing happened. sua sponte, the Supreme Court of Alaska, reviewed the McKay matter. Mm-hmm. And Justice Diamond, who had voted to disbar McKay originally, wrote what must have been about the fifth opinion in the McKay case. There was no petition or anything, no request for it. It was just a sua sponte, short opinion, just a couple of pages, Supreme Court of Alaska, saying that we now conclude that we committed a grave injustice to Mr. McKay, and he is hereby reinstated. Signed, Diamond, from the court.
Who besides Boyko talked to Hickam?
I don't know. I did not.
Were there other people? He's Republican, so it wasn't going to be Wendell Kay.
Oh yeah, anybody could talk to Wally about this. You're, you know, sure,
did.
Sure,
so is that what it was?
Sure, sure.
So that's the end of the court bar fight, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
how it came out. So now does the court stay out of the bar's business, more or less?
Yes, I think they. I don't really know under the present rules whether every matter in which an attorney is disciplined, whether those are all reviewed by the Supreme Court or not. I think that if an attorney is exonerated by the Board of Governors, that's the end of it, and the court doesn't see it.
How did they managed to keep jurisdiction over McKay after they'd already lost out on all their new rules?
Inherent power, right out of the sky. See, he was writing opinions like he was God Almighty. You know, mm-hmm. It was scary, and some of the language to me. Of course, yeah, there's history for that. You know, in Judge Roy Bean's time, mm-hmm. I suppose the bar in Judge Roy Bean's court consisted of those people who claimed to be attorneys, mm-hmm. and whose names appeared on a list kept by the clerk of the court. And if Judge Bean wanted to get rid of a judge, he'd tell the clerk to cross his name off. And you were no longer a lawyer, and that, you know, and so there's that kind of bar. Bar in the very narrow sense of being that group of attorneys who are recognized before a particular tribunal.
Was there any major change from territorial to statehood days with the conduct of the bar or the conduct of
the legal profession? Complete revolution, because Justice Nesbitt did a beautiful job on organizing the new court system. Mm-hmm. He really had tremendous administrative ability. And he got all kinds of concessions from the federal people. You know, we got to stay on. Who ever heard of a state court in a federal courthouse? But there we were, you see. And we of course, got our own Supreme Court, which meant state questions would go to them, and you didn't have to go to the Ninth Circuit. But the main thing was the appointment of that first group of Superior Court judges. Mm-hmm. Fitzgerald, Davis, Cooper, I forget who else was in that first group in Anchorage, but it meant that we had, instead of just one court in Anchorage, one judge at a time, well, we'd had visiting judges, you know, and yet, but we went from one court to, I guess, five overnight, and that opened things up, and we could start to practice law, and we had a lot of fun.
When you say start to practice law?
Well, I mean get our cases heard, get things moving.